It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Glad you could be here. Worldwide sales of heat pumps, they are set to soar to record levels in coming years. And that's according to the International Energy Agency, pointing out that it's the global energy crisis that's accelerating demand. But what about Wisconsin winters? Can we rely on heat pumps just like a conventional furnace and AC unit? Call in with your questions and comments about heat pumps, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Travis Herzog is a residential estimator and heat pump specialist for Midwest Heating and Cooling. Travis, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you for having me. Happy to be here.
All right. So sort these out for us. The EPA says there are three main kinds of heat pumps. It's air-to-air, water source, and geothermal. Can you explain the distinctions?
Yeah, absolutely. So air-to-air heat pump is going to be either a traditional heat pump. It almost looks like an air conditioner or a mini split system. And what that does is it draws the outdoor air. And depending on the temperature, you're either going to warm or cool that air and then send it through your forced air system or ductlessly through the wall head unit. Your water-to-air source heat pump is going to draw outdoor air and actually use a water-based system with a hydronic system that's going to run through a forced air system. And then your geothermal is going to actually be a ground loop that you're going to have a drilling company drill. And you're going to run that through, again, a forced air system, but that is a little bit more intricate process with construction.
And so what type of system do you see that's most popular with customers? Where are people trending?
Air-to-air. There's only a few air-to-water source systems, and geothermals are either space-restrictive or cost-restrictive. So the air-to-air is definitely the most popular.
And so with air-to-air, you mentioned this is one unit. It's one unit doing the heating and the cooling. Where do you place it?
So think about it. Let's talk about unitary systems. So if you think about it, it looks just like an air conditioner. It's a little bit wider and taller than a traditional than most traditional air conditioners. And it's going to actually hook up just like an air conditioner would hook up, but you have a double stack coil in above your furnace. Normally, you just have one A-shaped coil for an air conditioner. This will have two that either heat or cool. And then you are going to have a backup air handler with a heat kit, or you're going to have a traditional furnace, and it'll switch off based on the thermal points for the heating portion of it, and it'll run 100% of your cooling.
So considering like our current gas furnace, how does it integrate with our home's ductwork?
Great question. So it'll integrate just like a normal AC system and furnace system. It'll look exactly the same. The coil set will just be a little bit taller. The biggest thing is how the furnace and the outdoor heat pump figure out at what temperature do we switch over, what makes sense, what is best for the system itself. And there's actually a communicating technology between the two systems. So there's only certain furnaces that can communicate with these heat pumps.
All right, let's talk efficiency and make some comparisons here. You know, the EPA says modern heat pumps can lower electricity costs for heating by as much as 50% compared to furnaces and baseboard heaters. So are the upfront costs for heat pumps more expensive than traditional, than conventional furnaces?
Yes and no. And that comes down to the way that the government has set up this rebate system. So initially, you're going to spend a little more, but right now, you can qualify for $2,000 tax credit, focus on energy, $1,300. So right off the bat, there's $3,300 that'll come off of the system, both for focus and a tax credit.
Okay, so the federal tax credit covers 30% of the cost of purchase and installation up to $2,000. Is that now underway?
The 25C tax credit is available, and you can see that on IRS.gov. The form itself is not available yet, but it will be before the tax, before next year's tax season. So it is a form they're working on, but it is something that is currently available at this time.
I'm going to reintroduce you here for a moment as we talk about heat pumps and get your questions answered. Travis Herzog, residential estimator for an HVAC company. You can join in the conversation. What you want to know about heat pumps, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. You know, how well does a home need to be insulated for the heat pump to work at maximum efficiency?
I would say, you know, it's going to work either way. It's just if you want to maximize your home's energy efficiency, you want to be at least the average, if not slightly above. But I think in this cold climate, everyone should be at that level.
Okay. Yeah. And, you know, another thing in terms of efficiency, what are the comparisons that you can make between high-efficiency gas furnaces that are on the market and heat pumps that you're putting in?
It comes down to how much energy it's going to actually output based on how much gas furnace needs for BTUs. So you get into this kilowatts per BTU versus BTUs itself. And once you do the calculation, you figure out about 15 to 20 degrees is your sweet spot where you want to switch over to the gas furnace. But if you're running in the mid-20s, 30 degrees, 40 degrees, this is going to be probably about 20 to 30% more efficient than most high-efficiency for heating.
Wow, that's really significant. You know, as you talk with customers about them, do you find that, you know, we're looking at numbers here and that there's a surge of demand for heat pumps? What is the demand like here in Wisconsin?
It's pretty high. We work with a company out in Madison, Renew Energy. So we tend to get a lot of people that are going the solar route and trying to get off of natural gas. And as that kind of starts to come to a head, I think we'll see more and more of it in the future.
Okay. Let's take a call now. Mitch joining us from Middleton. Mitch, hi.
Yeah, hi. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Great. So, yeah, my question is for our, you know, you mentioned it at the beginning with the really sub-zero winters and really cold nights. Do we need like a backup system for these heat pumps, whether it's our existing furnaces or if we want to make the switch to all electrical, would like a electric baseboard heat work as a backup system if they are needed?
Thank you, Mitch. Yes, great question. Travis?
Yeah, absolutely. So if you're talking about going all electric, what you want to look at is you want to look at doing an air handler system. Our system actually uses a comfort bridge, technology with a cool cloud app, it's called, and you actually have a communicating system. So we can put a heat strip that'll back up with electric to your duct system, so you don't need baseboard heat or anything. We can put a traditional forced air system in. It would just use that electric as backup when it gets too cold.
Is that a misconception you find about heat pumps that they don't work here in Wisconsin because in bitterly cold, it just wouldn't be feasible?
All the time. There's a very older generation of HVAC work that folks have always had the traditional, they don't work, they don't work, they don't work. And there's still some of that mentality, but technology has really come a long way. And we're one of the people on the forefront of it trying to tell people, no, it does work, and we've proven that time and time again.
Travis Herzog is a residential estimator and heat pump specialist in Maguanago. Join in with your questions on how to heat and cool your space, what you wonder about heat pumps. Perhaps your furnace is on its last legs and you're doing your research on heat pumps. Call in with your questions, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. As heat pumps steadily make their way into people's homes and demand surges in other parts of the world, we wonder in Wisconsin, can they withstand our frigid temps? We've been talking about that. Call in with questions about heat pumps and transferring of heat efficiency, 800-642-1234. Travis Herzog is here, heat pump specialist in Wisconsin. Travis, we've talked about handling the sub-zero weather. What about heat waves? How can heat pumps handle the really hot weather?
Yeah, they're even better than your traditional air conditioning systems because they use the ones we like to use an inverter technology. So they can be a 10 to 1 turn down ratio, meaning they can use 10, 20, 30% of what your energy cost is, and they really adjust themselves. So they're extremely efficient in comparison to the most standard air.
What about maintenance? Because, like, we get a furnace check once a year. What is maintenance like on these systems?
Same thing as getting a standard tune-up. We just need to come out, check your pressure levels, check your refrigerant levels. Think about it like getting an air conditioning tune-up. It's really not that much different.
Okay, so there are refrigerant levels in this unit. Is that something that have to be topped off or checked?
You don't necessarily have to top it off. You just want to make sure that the pressure levels are correct. Anytime you have to top something off, I think there's...
All right, let's take another call now. Landon in Madison. Landon, hi.
Hi, I just wanted to call and share a positive experience that I've had with heat pumps. I bought my first home in 2020, and it was built in the early 80s when the oil embargo was going on, or shortly thereafter. So it was a home that did not have any sort of gas line that was connected into the home. So it's 100% electric. We had electric baseboard heat, and for only about 1,100 square feet, we were paying about $325, $330 a month in the coldest months of the year for heat. We switched to a heat pump system because we also did not have air conditioning. Does both with three heads within the house right now. Does a great job. We save on average $100 a month during the coldest months. It's been great for us. I just wanted to share that experience.
And Landon, when did you switch over to heat pump? I missed that.
May 2021, so we spent one winter with electric baseboard heat and one summer without any air conditioning, and we decided that was not going to work in the long run. So we switched to a heat pump AC system for about $9,000 total, a little bit under, before these incentives came out, but I still would have done it. So, yeah.
Yeah, Landon, sounds like you're not looking back, that it's really been a positive move, positive system in your setup.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Thank you so much for sharing that story. And Travis, what stands out to you about Landon's switchover in 2021?
You know, the impressive thing is you show people these ductless systems. That's what it sounds like he has. And he said three heads. So these little wall-mounted units that are about 34 to 38 inches wide can crank out a whole lot more. And people look at it and I'll show up and they'll go, that's it? That's all you're putting in here? And I said, trust me, it's going to work. I promise you, this is what's going to work. And time and time again, people are impressed at how much these little things actually output and how durable they are.
Do I have to upgrade my electrical panel? Say you have an older home. What about your electrical panel?
You know, that is a great question. It depends on the situation. If you're going all electric, there is a chance you're going to have quite a few breaker spaces or upgrade your electrical system. If you're adding a ductless system, they only use two breaker spaces, and they're pretty easy to install. So it just really depends on everyone's situation and what they're looking to go at.
Let's go to Ron now, calling from Pioneer, Missouri. Ron, go ahead.
I bought a 70-year-old fixer-upper, about 1,000 square feet. It already had an air-to-air heat pump and natural gas furnace backup. Is it mechanically feasible to add a vertical loop, you know, ground source heat pump onto that same compressor, and would it still work? And then this other idea that I just thought of was, is it mechanically feasible to also add a D superheater, which would be plumbed immediately downstream from the compressor, and it would put the excess heat into my natural gas-fired water heater? Disclosure, in '84, I worked 7 months for the Missouri Geological Survey, traveled to all 114 counties searching for injection water wells that were plumbed to heat pump systems. There were many great ones. The terrible one had been bought, maybe designed by an architect in a medium-sized city. It could handle a 40, let me think. It could keep the house 40 degrees warmer than the outdoor temperature. So when we had a severe winter, 20 below zero, it was 60 degrees.
Okay. Well, Ron, I want to toss this over to Travis here and some technical aspects here. Travis, go ahead.
Yeah. So what I would direct them towards, because we're not going to Missouri, I don't think, is to... if you're looking at doing a geothermal unit, there's a great company out in Ohio called Water Furnace. They have a great website that kind of explains a lot of how that system's going to work. But if you currently have an outdoor heat pump unit, a unitary system, you would have to switch over to a geothermal system. And those indoor units that look like furnaces are all self-contained heating, cooling, and heat pump systems with backup all in one. So it would be an entirely different indoor unit altogether that you would need in comparison to what the unit you're using now.
Ron, thank you. Talking about heat pumps, all things heat pumps, with Travis Herzog, residential estimator at an HVAC company. John in Milwaukee is the impetus for this deep dive on heat pumps. Let's hear what John had to say.
I was wondering if homes that have hot water heat and boilers can be... retrofitted to use heat pumps.
Can they be retrofitted?
Yeah. There is a unit built by a company called FacePack that does a high-velocity system. It's used in many boiler homes to bring air conditioning in. They actually make a hydronic system that can go down to negative 22 degrees. It is fairly expensive to put in, but it definitely can work, and it can heat and cool your entire home with a forced air system.
John, I hope that helps, and thank you so much for the caller-only suggestion. Let's go to Doug in Mauston. Doug, hi.
Hi. I built my house in 97 and had a heat pump AC unit put in, air handler in the attic, and then I have a wood-fired boiler for in-floor radiant heat, and I'm looking at upgrading. I'm getting older. I don't want to be doing the wood boiler anymore. And wondering if you have any recommendations. I do have the capability of doing a ground source heat pump also, because we're thinking about doing a remodel to where I could do some excavating and put in a ground loop. Would I be able to plumb that in for my in-floor radiant? Because I love warm floors.
Thank you, Doug. Travis?
Yeah, great question. It all depends on how your system is set up, what's your temperature. I would guess it's probably high temp, 180 degrees. I don't know if the ground source will be able to accommodate that type of heating number. So you may have to look at like a air-to-water source heat pump instead of a ground source. But it would be something we'd have to look at and take a case by case and take the numbers of an engineer.
What is a typical lifespan, though, on an air-to-air unit you install now?
You know, a lot of people say 10 to 15. I would say as long as they're maintained, you keep up with them. Ours come with a pretty good warranty. You could probably get 15 to 20 out of them as long as they're taken care of.
Are there any supply chain issues? Is there a weight?
Great question. Depending on the unit, if you wanted a Mitsubishi unit, there may be a weight. Our units are private labeled through Dyson, Goodman, and Manna, so we actually do not have a weight at all to get the units or the mini split systems through Dyson.
And this is still an emerging technology. Could they be better in 5 years if we wait to install them?
Yeah, I mean, I would tell you that your phone's going to be better in 5 years. Technology is going to take us above and beyond. I mean, these things could be, you know, the size of a pocket watch in 20 years, who knows? But the technology is getting better and better and better as we move on, just like everything.
Well, Travis, we appreciate you answering our heat pump questions. Thank you for joining us.
Hey, thank you for having me. I appreciate the opportunity.
Travis Herzog is a heat pump specialist for Midwest Heating and Cooling. And once again, thank you so much to John in Milwaukee, who suggested we have a heat pump conversation. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with the story of an historic part of Milwaukee.
There's a peninsula just off Lake Michigan in Milwaukee that has lived many lives. Today, Jones Island is home to a sewage treatment plant, piles of salt, and rail cars. But it was once home to thriving communities.
Indian, French-Canadian, Yankee, and Polish, each utterly erased by the one that followed before today's landscape emerged. Few places in Wisconsin have seen such profound change, and fewer still have so many tales to tell.
Jones Island is the subject of a new Milwaukee PBS documentary by author and historian John Gerda. In People of the Port, a Jones Island documentary, Gerda talks about the Potawatomi who lived there and used the area to fish, gather wild rice, and race ponies. After the Potawatomi were displaced, European immigrants began settling down on Jones Island. As Gerda tells us, a Polish immigrant community flocked to the area, drawn in for the same reasons as Jones Island's earliest settlers, which was fishing.
It's not a tourist attraction. Jones Island lies just blocks from downtown Milwaukee, but visitors are few. What they see is freight yards, fuel tanks, docks, the Danhone Freeway Bridge, and the largest sewage treatment plant in Wisconsin. Here was the city's front door in the age of sail, and here is the hub of its urban infrastructure today. What it lacks in glamour, Jones Island makes up for in stories. For nearly 50 years, from the 1870s to the 1920s, the peninsula was the site of a commercial fishing village settled by immigrants from the Baltic Sea coast of Poland. These Kashubes, as they were called, numbered more than 1,500 by the turn of the 20th century. First in rowboats near the shore, then in motorized tugs that chugged over the horizon, they brought up 2 million pounds of fish in a typical year, including lake trout, whitefish, herring, perch, and sturgeon. Their catch was a critical source of protein for Milwaukee's growing population. Fishing also provided a livelihood for one of the most unusual urban villages in America. Jones Island was a colony of squatters who occupied their land without benefit of title. Their homes were makeshift, their street system was improvised, and their shoreline was a maze of fish sheds, boathouses, and massive wooden net drying reels. The setting was so picturesque that artists from the mainland were among the most frequent visitors. What they found was a complete human community. Jones Island was a complex web of interrelated families who supported social clubs, a baseball team, a chorus, and a total of 11 saloons, each serving its own version of the Friday night fish fry. The Kashubes were also faithful members of St. Stanislaus Catholic Church. Whole families could be seen every Sunday morning, rowing across the Kinnickinnick River in their finest clothes to Mass on Mitchell Street. Jones Island may have been picturesque, but its days were numbered. As mainland Milwaukeeans enjoyed electricity, running water, and indoor plumbing, the Kashubes were still getting by with kerosene lamps, contaminated wells, and backyard privies. By 1910, as the city's population surged toward 400,000, there was an urgent need for two major improvements, a sewage treatment plant and an outer harbor. Jones Island was the obvious location for both. In 1914, the city condemned the fishing colony. Family by family, its residents moved to the mainland. In less than a decade, the number of dwellings plunged from more than 200 to just 6. Most of the holdouts lived on the riverside of the peninsula. Their unofficial mayor was Felix Struck, a one-time fishing tug captain who had come ashore to run a weather-beaten saloon called the Old Harbor. His time was finally up in 1943, near the midpoint of World War II, when Struck was evicted for reasons of what authorities called port security. The old fisherman moved to a new home on the south side. 5 months later, he was dead. In a moment of inspired whimsy, the city turned the site of Captain Strzok's last stand into a park and named it for the island's dominant ethnic group. Kashub's Park is the smallest in Milwaukee, about the size of a basketball court, but it occupies a unique place in the city. In the midst of today's manufactured landscape, the park is the last reminder that Jones Island was once a living, breathing human community.
John Gerda is an author and historian who lives in Milwaukee. He also co-created a new Milwaukee PBS documentary, People of the Port, a Jones Island documentary. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Maureen McCollum.
It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. NASA's three-year project to more accurately predict storms is concluding. Scientists went up into the eye of storms on over 30 flights to figure out what's really going on up there. Call in with questions about this research to help weather forecasters better predict snowstorms. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Lynn McMurdy is a meteorologist and research associate professor in the Department of Atmospheric Sciences at the University of Washington, and she led the NASA Impacts Project through this winter. Lynn, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Oh, I'm happy to be here.
Well, explain the importance of this project and what bearing it has on your research.
Well, thanks for asking. This research we are examining the structures of snowfall within snowstorms. And the tricky part about that is in any kind of storm, snowfall is not evenly distributed. It's often organized in certain ways, sometimes in banded structures. And we're trying to understand that aspect of the snowstorms. And by understanding that better, the processes that create the banded structures, the types of what's called microphysics or the cloud particles inside them, and how we can do remote sensing from radars and radiometers. This will help us improve our forecasting of those snowstorms and improve our ability to measure the snowstorms from space-borne instrumentation.
Is Mother Nature really that tricky? Why is predicting the exact amount of snowfall in a storm still so challenging?
Mother Nature is very tricky. It always has a trick up its sleeve, I'll tell you that. It's difficult because in a numerical model, which is what we use to help predict the placement of storms, these cloud processes are very, very hard to, you know, simulate. And we don't understand them well. And so that's why we are out there making measurements of as many aspects of the storm as possible to help improve our numerical models. So that's one aspect that's tricky. And I swear every time we went out on a flight and we had predictions of where the storms were, approximately where it might be snowing heavily, and we would go out there and it would not be the case. And we would go, oh no, we are in the wrong spot. We have to move over. And so it was difficult for even us trying to make our measurements to find the good spots to be to make them in the snowstorms themselves. Excuse me.
That's what I'm wondering. Did some of the aha moments and key breakthroughs in the research happen up in the air during these flights, or was it more down on the ground after you had really sorted through data and instrumentation and modeling?
Well, it's actually a little of both.
Okay.
I literally just got back from our third deployment less than a week ago. And so all the data that we collected this last year, this January and February, haven't analyzed yet because you have to do quality control. So it's going to be a while before we really dig in. So it's really a combination of both. When you're in the field, you're very much immersed in the details of each storm that you're sampling. And, you know, you're with your colleagues and you're talking about it as we're going, like, what do you think is going on here? Because we do see We have what's called quick look imagery that we look at real time as the aircraft are flying, and we're all scratching our heads trying to figure out what we're looking at. And so we talk amongst ourselves and have ideas, and we try to write them all down so we don't forget. And then later, after we kind of quality controlled individual people, we'll start digging much, much deeper into it. And some of our grandiose ideas we had in the field, we thought, oh, what were we thinking? Those are completely wrong. And others are surprisingly like, why? Why didn't we see this before? This is how it's working. So it's really a lot of both. You really need, you know, you have inspiration moments when you're in the aircraft, or in my case, I was often on the ground helping to direct the aircraft. And you have inspiration moments when you're alone with your computer and analyzing the data itself and seeing things you didn't notice before.
And your work has taken you through winter storms across the country, including here in the upper Midwest. What storms do you remember most vividly?
Boy, that's a tough question. Each year has kind of several very memorable storms. Last year, more of the storms were on the Northeast and up into Canada, and one of them was a classic nor'easter storm, and which is what we were hoping to get. We only got like one or two of those type events.
I was going to say that's your bread and butter.
Yeah, you would hope. It's actually, people think it's common. It's not very common. I'll tell you that. It didn't happen often in the last 3 years that we were sampling. That one storm, we knew it was coming, but it was difficult to design how we were going to sample it. But finally, we get out there. The two aircraft, I could tell you a little background about how we're doing our sampling. We have two different aircraft that we fly in coordination with one another. So that means they're flying on the exact same line, but at different altitudes. So one aircraft always flies very high. It's, above 60,000 feet. It's called the ER2, and it has remote sensing instrumentation. Remote sensing means you're away from where you're trying to measure, but you use a technique like a radar. So it sends out a signal, and it backscatters back the information depending on how much snowfall.
So that would be
rain.
Like a top-down view of a storm system if you're up, 65,000 or so feet from that vantage point. Okay.
Yes, you're exactly a top down, and it has a very detailed vertical distribution. So you see lots of details in a line. And so you can go back and forth on the same line, or you can move over if you do several lines in a row, like spatially, you can kind of map out in a three-dimensional way the structure of your storm. So that's one aircraft flying high up there. But the second one is one other people can be on. So I've ridden on this one before. I wasn't on this particular flight. And it flies inside the clouds at different altitudes, and at the same, usually pretty low. We vary between 25,000 feet and down to 5,000 feet above the ground. And so one of the things that you're trying to do in real time is to tell that aircraft at what level to fly. So we told the airplane to fly, I can't remember exactly what it was, let's say 9,000 feet or 8,000 feet, like, okay, go in this line. And they hit the worst turbulence.
Oh, dear.
And so so the people on the plane, we can chat with them in real time, and we get these messages going, whoa, this is worse than Six Flags. And then apparently the pilot said, we have to get out of this level. And they literally, without permission from air traffic control, went to a different level because it was actually getting dangerous. it was so rocky. So none of us expected that kind of turbulence. And so analyzing that case has been really interesting. There's lots of unexpected wave features in that case, very strong, what's called shear, which is a change of wind speed with height, in a very short distance. That's usually what makes turbulence. One of the things I love looking at right after the flight is on that lower aircraft, it's called the P3. They have these called cloud probes. So they're actually taking pictures of the shapes of the cloud and precipitation size particles in the clouds. So, you know, like when it snows and you hold your sleeve out, you see, oh, look, isn't that a pretty little dendrite star? Oh, those are all really cool. But they look pretty small. You can't really see the details. The cloud probes can really see the details. And so some of them are just amazing shapes and sizes, things you'd never seen before.
I love it. They're kind of like snowflake modeling in a way.
Yeah, they are.
Let me just reintroduce you here, research meteorologist and atmospheric scientist at the University of Washington. Lyndon McMurdy studies the structure of storms, how they form, all these weather-related mysteries. Call in with your questions about weather radar, how predictive modeling works. 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We learn what atmospheric scientists grapple with in modeling snowstorms and what's happening in ice-filled clouds. NASA's three-year research campaign called Impacts just wrapped up. Scientists flew on dozens of flights in severe weather. Call in with your questions and comments about storm prediction, 800-642-1234. University of Washington Research Associate Professor in Atmospheric Sciences Lynn McMurdy was part of the Impacts mission and stays with us. Lynn, I was so surprised. NASA said this was the first comprehensive study of snowstorms across the eastern U.S. in 30 years. And just think about how powerful computers have become in three decades. How did the technology help in this research and just so many of the latest and greatest new technologies out there?
Yeah, that's a great question. It's really evolved tremendous in the last 30 years. So I almost can't know where to begin. We use the technology that, you know, we're trying to improve forecasting of weather, but it's really has improved a lot over the last 30 years, especially in the tracking of the storms. What needs more improvement is the distribution of snowfall and rainfall within the storms. That's where we're trying to improve. But, the technology that we are able to fly these aircraft to be able to coordinate them, the software that we use to make sure we have both airplanes in the same location at the same time, to be able to, the way that we communicate with them, it's really mind-boggling. That and the instrumentation has really evolved a lot on our high-flying remote sensing aircraft. That we had four different radars at different wavelengths, the really extremely high resolution. The details we're getting just have not, you know, been able to. What was it? We couldn't do that 30 years ago. The other aircraft with its cloud probes, and we had one of them, you know, one that does the detailed pictures. Mm-hmm. That's very technical laser technology. Didn't exist 30 years ago. So wow. Almost every instrument we had did not exist, or at least not in the quality that we have it now.
Let's take a call now. Marcus in Milwaukee. Marcus, what would you like to ask?
Good morning. So my question for your guest is, what does she make of what's known as the phenomenon of a dead man walking, which is basically two tornadoes that wrap around each other? And literally, it looks like a dead man walking. The last one that I know in the United States, I believe it hit Gerald, Texas, and it killed a bunch of people. Mm. So I guess I just like her thoughts.
Yeah, Marcus, thank you. I would imagine, too, you weren't flying into the eye of tornadoes.
No, we were not doing that. Yes. Yeah, that's too dangerous to do, obviously, because of the shear and such. So I'm not familiar with the event that the caller talked about, but tornadoes are a kind of a different type of phenomena than the snowstorms that we're sampling. Tornadoes are driven by very severe convection that organizes into a mesoscale rotation. And sometimes you can have two that are right next to each other and rotate in opposite directions. And the, you know, is sort of like a ice skater effect. What a tornado does, the air comes in towards, it's trying to go up in a very strong updraft. But as it rotates around, it spins up into a funnel cloud. So I'm not an expert in tornadoes, so I can't give you any more insights than to know that they're, you know, please listen to whenever you hear a severe storm warning, because that means they've seen a signature of a potential tornado, and please take cover. That would be my opinion. Please take care of yourself if you're ever in that situation.
Such good advice. Lynn, you know, back in 2020, when this program was launching, you talked about hoping it would really help advance storm prediction. And I'm wondering, has it achieved what you had in mind?
Well, that goal is probably our most long-term goal.
Okay.
We have done studies right now with our data from 2020, so that's like 3 years ago that we collected the data, and it's taken that long to analyze it, comparing what the model predicted for the snowfall and what we measured. So that's one of the ways that we can test how good our models are doing. We actually make the measurements of the quantities that you need in your models to make snowfall predictions. And so we, of course, found that the model didn't do great. We tested different ways of running the models, and some did better, some did worse. So that's what, you know, one of our hopes is, like, can we find the best combination of the different parameters that we have, you know, like sort of like turning knobs. You know,
sure.
We could turn this knob or that knob. Which ones, how far should we turn this one? How far should we turn that one? So our measurements can help inform that. So I'm only at that stage. One of my colleagues who is part of the project is trying to use the data that we collect and initialize a model run. So every time you run a forecast model, you have to start it with observations, you know, and put it in a grid. And so that's called data assimilation. So they're testing using the detailed radar data that we collected. Can this help us make our predictions better? If you start with the right initialization, will you go forward in time better than if you didn't have very good starting point? So we're exploring that too. So this is one of those long-term, will take a lot of time to understand and figure out.
Well, I appreciate you sharing this research, and thank you for joining us, Lynn.
Oh, I really enjoyed it. Thanks so much.
Lynn McMurdy is a meteorologist and research associate professor in the Department of Atmospheric Sciences at the University of Washington. She led the NASA IMPACTS mission this winter. It stands for the Investigation of Microphysics and Precipitation for Atlantic Coast Threatening Storms. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network.